everyone, and welcome to episode 81, where I have the pleasure of interviewing Graham Yost, the writer of part 7 of this series and also the writer of the movie Speed. So sit back and enjoy and listen to what Graham has to say. First of all, I wanted to thank you for joining me and being willing to discuss Band of Brothers with me.
Anything you want to know, anything I can help you with.
Okay, so why don't you tell me your story of how you got connected to Band of Brothers?
Right. So it all honestly started the project before that with Tom Hanks,
right.
Which
you're
back in
From the Earth
to the Moon. So yeah. Back in 96 or so, I got a call from my agent and Karen Sage, and she said, Tom Hanks is doing a miniseries about the Apollo space program for HBO. Would you be interested? And I said, hell yes, I'm a space nut. I remember watching the moon landing. I'm old enough that actually was a thing. And I was 9 years old. And anyway, so I said yes, and I met with Hanks. I don't know if he was doing That Thing You Do, his first movie that he directed. And I don't think I met with him for a while, but there was a phone call and stuff. And then I met with the people at his office, and he called his company at that point Clavius Base, which was named after a base on the moon in 2001. So I go in and meet with them. The episode I wanted to do was about the fire in Apollo 1. And couldn't get that, but I ended up getting that, and that changed my life. I became a much better writer because of working on that show, and Hanks supported me, and I got to direct an episode on that show. It was a transformative experience. Frank Darabont was going to direct the episode that I wrote. He ended up not doing it. David Frankel did, but we were talking about casting. And he said, I got to tell you, I kept on flipping back to the title page and going, wow, this is the bus guy. And because I had written Speed and yes. I was the bus guy. Right. And so I was looked at as a certain type of writer. And this was a different thing. And it was because the challenge was these were real people. I've got to treat them with, you know, the most respect and honesty and everything. And Dave Scott was our astronaut advisor. He was a command module pilot in Apollo 9 and commander of the mission in 15, the first to drive a rover on the moon. So I got to know Dave quite well. And the one thing he said to me, he said, you got the culture right. You got the culture right. Wow. And so that was a huge pat on the back. He was very supportive. So we do From the Earth to the Moon. It's a project done by humans, so there is frictions and there's stuff and there's all this stuff. And I luckily, the episode I directed, I got to direct right to the end because they had other fires to put out. So I was doing cuts and answering notes and very, very proud of it. And then, but there were some frictions. So I heard about Band of Brothers. I remember. So Tom Hanks would visit the set in Florida. We were right at Disney in the offices, and he would sneak out, don't tell anyone, for a cigarette with me. Don't tell anyone. I don't smoke anymore. I'm sure he doesn't smoke anymore. But he would tell me stories about doing this film with Spielberg called Saving Private Ryan. And he said, you know, what it was like when they're shooting in Ireland and shooting D-Day. And I was like, holy shit. And so it had a big effect on him, had a big effect on Spielberg. And so then I heard that they were doing this thing, Band of Brothers. And I was on AOL one day. And by the way, as you know, I'm still an AOL member because it's coming back, baby. I feel it.
No,
it's not. I'm just lazy. One of the writers on one of the people who had worked on, I don't think he wrote on Earth to the Moon, but he was part of the inner circle at what then became Playtone for Hanks's company. And he was on AOL instant messaging. And I sent him a snarky. He said, how you doing? And I said, well, snarky, sarcastic. Well, thanks for, you know, inviting me to be a part of Band of Brothers. And he immediately texted back, do you want to be?
Wow.
And I said, yes. And he said, let me check with the guys. He got back the next day and he said, everyone would love to have you. And I said, I thought they were mad at me. He said they thought you were that you were mad at them, which was a classic human story, right? We project what we think the other person is thinking, and who the hell knows what they're actually thinking.
You can say
So
whatever you want. It's okay. You don't have
yeah,
to.
so but they weren't mad at me and I wasn't mad at them, but that's how it turned out. And so then I got to be part of band, and I remember meeting Tom had offices then. The Band of Brothers sort of, I think it was at Lantana in LA, the sort of complex of where people, producers and directors and productions have offices in Santa Monica. And he was dieting to get down for the shooting the second half of Castaway. So the way they did it was he ate, I said, when he was gaining weight for the first half, I said, "What did you eat?" He said, "Anything I wanted." He would have like this triple Sunday every night just to put on weight for the first half. And then for the second half, he was just eating turkey jerky and drinking water. I mean, it was just, and so, but it was slow. It was doctor supervised, but he was like losing weight, and we're meeting on, and it's the other writers are there. There's Bruce McKenna and John Orloff and Max Fry. Eric Janderson was sort of, you know, the commander of the whole thing. He was leading the charge on the writing. Eric Bork was writing. I think Tom may have written one. I know he directed one.
I know he directed one. I don't think he wrote one. I don't think so.
He maybe he didn't. And
I mean,
so
he might have helped with writing something, but
well, his fingerprints are all over band.
right.
His fingerprints are all over From the Earth to the
It,
Moon. He was
especially
very.
when you see typewriters on screen.
When you ever see any typewriters, I once asked him the German film The Lives of Others, and I said, "What did you think of that, Tom?" He said, "It's about spies and typewriters. What do you think I thought?" I have over in the corner here an old typewriter. It turns out there was a machine called the Yost Writing Machine Company back 140 years
Oh,
ago,
wow.
and I found one. I asked Tom, "How much should I offer?" And he said, "We'll offer a couple hundred." He said, "But then go to a." He said, "Do you know how much I would pay if there was a Hanks writing machine company?" And then it showed up in the mail about a month later. He got it for me and sent it over. So,
And is there any connection to you on that, or
no, just the name.
just coincidence?
So as far as I know, so I was a writer on it, and. Very clear, I'm not going to be a producer. I'm not going to be a director. I'm just a writer. And it's like fine with that. And honestly, band was, it's one of the best jobs I've ever had. There was a great deal of camaraderie among the writers. There was one thing that they didn't really have, but kind of had, which is something I feel is critically important, which is a showrunner. Eric Janderson was kind of that. It was kind of Tom. But that person who, you know, all the scripts go through, that person who is keeping track of everything, that was a little bit more ad hoc.
Okay.
For example, there were things where Bruce McKenna, who wrote part six, which was, the first part of the whole Bastogne sequence, and it was
Yeah.
about,
I spoke with Bruce.
okay. So he said to me, he said, "I see in your script you've got Norman Dyke yawning a lot." He said, "I'll set that up for you if you pay off Eugene Rowe in your episode." I mean, there was a little bit of horse trading between the writers. You set this up and blah, blah, blah. But we all got sat around a table, and they later said to me that they were glad I came in because I was someone who had been through the sort of the Tom Hanks of doing a miniseries. And by the way, I mean, just. Everyone says, "Oh, he's the nicest man in Hollywood." Yeah, I don't know if he's the nicest man, but he certainly is very honest and straightforward and funny and is a good guy. Nothing but praise and gratitude there for me. So then we started dividing up, and early on, I was told I would get part seven, and I remember them saying to me, "We've got Donnie Wahlberg to play Lipton, and we would like to have an episode sort of featuring him. And we think maybe seven would be a good one to feature Lipton." And I said, "Okay." I honestly was not that familiar with Donnie Wahlberg. They said, well, he's the guy in the first scene of The Sixth Sense. And I knew he was in Kids on the Block, but he was in Sixth Sense. It was like, oh shit. Oh, that was him? Yeah. I said, oh, okay.
Yeah, I think he was on Tom Hanks's jerky and water diet when he did that also. No, I mean, because he is so thin in that
Yeah,
birthday
no,
powder.
he went for it.
Yeah.
And I heard he was good in the movie, I think it was called Fear. I'll just jump forward really quickly. After Band of Brothers, I created a TV series just for Donnie. It was called Boomtown
I
on
love
NBC.
Boomtown is one of and this isn't because I'm just talking to you. Boomtown is one of my favorite movie TV shows because of the idea, the Rashomon aspect of it, and how in every single episode you think you know what's going on, and by the end your mind is completely blown. I was very upset that it got canceled after the second season. So sorry.
Well, so was I.
I can imagine.
And we could do a separate podcast on Boomtown if you want. I will say this, the whole idea for Boomtown came out of my experience working on Band of Brothers.
Wow.
And I'll get to that in a second. So they said, yeah, focus on Lipton. Well, as you know, talking to Bruce, talking to whoever else you've talked to, the guys were alive. And I got to know Carwood Lipton on the phone, and then got to meet him at the premiere. And I don't know if they've told you about the premiere week in France, but
Yeah,
holy
I heard
shit,
about it.
that was one of the most incredible weeks of any of our
Correct.
lives. I mean, it was
I've heard.
just bonkers. And yeah, so I got to talk to Lipton, and we had the book, we had the text to refer to, but we quickly found out that, Ambrose, the book is in a way short for what we were doing, and we needed more
Right. I
detail.
mean, it's one of
And
the
it
things.
was
There's
really.
one of the things that I've come across, obviously, while doing this podcast. You know, going through each episode 5 minutes at a time. I mean, it's there's you know sometimes you'll have one sentence in a book, and they turn that into a 3 minute segment. You know, within the miniseries, which you know obviously it makes sense. I mean, the perfect example is the spaghetti. You know, the spaghetti scene. It just mentions it. You know, in passing, and then. You know, I've always been amazed at how, you know, writers are able to do something like that. Take something small like that and expand on it. And my understanding is that most of you expanded on these things on your own, meaning you were, you know, you weren't talking to the guys and getting, you know, more details from them because you wanted to just expand on that particular scene. You know, within your writing mind, as opposed to having to make it completely based on what happened at the time.
Yeah, I mean, Tom would say that, and we did Earth to the Moon because he had done Apollo 13, and he was a space nut. But he would say Apollo 13 was about 50-60% accurate, and Earth to the Moon we were headed for about like 75. And I would say that with Band we aimed for about 75%, which is 25% completely made up. Did they actually say that? Maybe not. Something close to it, maybe. But tell the story that happened, but you have to pick out these things. And spaghetti was, that I could just t probably tell for, from Jenderson was just like, well, this is a great way to
Exactly.
demonstrate
Who Sobel?
what they went through and who Sobel was, right? And then the whole Sobel of it and how that arced out over the whole series and getting Schwimmer to do it. And I mean, all these things came together. I will jump forward this degree. I'm working on a show called Silo, and
I'm aware.
films in England. And I think there have been five actors from Band of Brothers in it because Cammie Patton is one of the casting agents on Silo. And we always say, is there something for Ross? Is there something for Shane Taylor? Is there something for, Robin Granger's and Gomez, Rick Gomez is my first go-to always. So he was in Band of Brother, he was in Band of Brothers, Boomtown. He was in, I don't know if he was in Reigns. He was had an ongoing part on Justified and now Silo. I wrote a part for him. because I wanted him on the show because he's funny, and Silo would have had no humor if it wasn't for getting Gomez in there. He's also just a great human being. So the echoes of Band continue in our lives, and you know, like Dexter Fletcher, I don't know if you saw the offer about the
Yes,
making of
of
The
course, of course.
Godfather. Yeah, it's filled with, I mean, there's, you know, Band of Brothers alums everywhere in that show. And Frank John Hughes plays Sinatra, for
Exactly.
Christ's sakes. You know, I mean, it's just like, so there is something about that casting that Meg Lieberman and Cammie Patton did, and Suzanne Smith, I believe she worked on Band, casting in England. That is just it's one of the great casting jobs of a generation. At any rate, so I get to do the episode about Lipton and about the second half of Bastogne, about getting into Foy, about, and then everything
That's right.
turning.
Again,
And
you get the
so, and
injuries of Joto. You get the injury of Garnier.
Garnier.
You get the you know the changing of the guard, basically. You know from
The changing
you
of the
know
guard.
from where
Yeah.
we
And
move into Spears. You know,
Compton's,
Compton's
yeah,
breakdown.
Compton's breakdown. Yeah. And so I started talking to all, I don't know if I talked to Buck. I did maybe briefly, but I talked to a lot of the guys, and they talked about the horror of being shelled, because there's nothing you can do. You can just hide in your foxhole. You maybe hope that the cover is good, and just, you have no idea, because if a shell comes straight down,
That's
you're
right.
done for. All that cover is going to do is protect you from shards coming down from the trees, basically. So they talked about that. They talked about Dyke. And if you've read any interviews with me about this over the years, you know that's my one regret, that I didn't rename that character, because I hated, when I realized, oh, hell, people are going to watch this thing, and the family and the descendants of Norman Dyke will go, grandpa, great grandpa, was remembered as being cowardly in the, in, or afraid,
Okay,
not cowardly, but
understandable.
afraid. And so I wish I'd renamed the character. But other than that, so the whole thing about Dyke, and I started to realize, as I was just noodling, I knew that I wanted to start with Hubler getting
And right.
getting the pistol, and then shooting himself in the leg and dying, because it's like, that's war. That's how effed
That's
up
right.
war is. It's just something stupid happens. Jumping forward in the Pacific, I did rewrote and but yeah, did an episode set on Cape Gloucester, which just rained all the time. More Marines were killed by falling trees than by Japanese soldier fire. You know, so it's stuff like that is part of war. So I knew I wanted to start with Hubler. That was a pretty early on choice. But then it was Lipton. Okay. So I was talking to all the guys, and I was talking, okay, Dyke kept on going back behind the lines. You know, even 50 meters back is a big difference to guys on, in when they're in one of these foxhole encampments. 100 meters is huge, 200 meters, you know. So talking to them, if Dyke kept on going back and he was yawning, and I remember someone saying, you know, cops will, when they're interrogating someone, if they see someone yawning, they know that they could be afraid. That yawning is sometimes it's a primal thing. You'll see it with lions just sitting and just looking out at the savannah. They're on edge. There's anxiety. So it's like, oh, okay, I'll let me have them yawn. And I can't honestly remember if I invented the yawning, or if the yawning was something that people said about Dyke. This is all lost
Right,
to
obviously.
history now. But then I kept on asking people, well, if it wasn't, who held the company together? Because Winters was now with
That's
the
right.
battalion. He couldn't be hands-on with Easy Company anymore. He still loved all the men and wanted, you know, was looking out for them, but he couldn't get in their affairs. Who's holding the company together? And Lipton said, oh, I don't know, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I don't know if I said to him, or if it just the want thought th went through my head, which is, oh God, Carwood, it was you. You held the company together. And I get choked up about
Of
that,
course.
just thinking about that, because he would never say that. He would never say that. So then I started to talk to the men about it, and they said, yeah, it was him. And because the other thing that came out of that was he got a battlefield promotion. He became a
That's right.
lieutenant after that. That didn't
Nope.
happen that much. That was a rarity. And so, and he would say that two things about Bastogne. One, that's when he started smoking, and he smoked for the next 40 years of his life.
Right.
Not
Well,
great, but man, he needed a bit.
when a rocket lands, when a dud rocket lands next to you, after knowing about what happened
Right
to
there.
Muck and Pinkala, obviously you're
Yeah.
gonna rethink your life. And if you want to smoke with George
Everything.
Luz, then.
Yep. To have a smoke. You sure? Yeah, it was. And there you go. And there's Gomez. But the other thing was that the battlefield promotion was perhaps the proudest moment of his life. He was absolutely, as the English would say, he was chuffed. He was not the kind of guy to ever be full of himself, but he was just like, holy shit, I am proud of that. And he also, the other thing he told me was that when they were going into, so episode three, oh hell, what are they trying to achieve?
Carrington.
Carantan. But it was early when, the great line of Winters, you follow the man who says, follow me. And he just takes up and they go and they're doing stuff. And Lipton climbed a tree to see what was
No.
going
Okay,
on. And he said,
that was in episode two, when they're at
in episode
Brandon Horn
two,
Manor. He climbs up a tree, and in the
Brandon
book
Horn
he
Manor.
says
So, yeah. And he
that if
said
he
he
had thought
would.
about it, now when he looks back, that was one of the stupidest things he's ever did.
He never did that again. He realized, oh my God. But he lucked out. He got some intel. It helped him. But it was just that thing. It was you, Carwood. It was you. And it was like, and as soon as I got that, it was like, now I know the story. Now I know that this is a story. My original title for the episode was A
Oh,
Question of
wow.
Leadership. The powers that be came up with Breaking Point, which is a better title. It's a little more dramatic and crunchy. But thematically, it was a question of leadership. And I love the idea that the guy who held the company together didn't realize that he was holding the company together. He was just doing what was needed. So he checked in on all the foxholes. He made sure everyone was okay. He was the person who could talk to Compton and see this and that and all of that. And that he got the battlefield promotion. And so I knew that that was going to be a climactic moment. And I wanted to have Spears say, it was
Right.
you. It was you, First Sergeant. So I had the episode. But then it was like, oh sh. There is so much stuff to talk about, like Foy and this, what they were doing this day and that day. And I
I
remember
have a question.
Kubrick.
How who decided
Sure.
where the breaks were going to be between the episodes? Meaning, you're given episode seven. You're doing episode seven, and you're told it starts at this point and it ends at this point. But who's making that decision?
The writers to a degree, the book to a degree, but it was really, whose story is it? And where does that begin in that part of the thing? So Eugene Roe in six, that goes only so
Right.
far because it's about him and the nurse and all this stuff. And that takes it so far. We knew that seven had to take us from the depths of them being bombarded and all that stuff through
That's right.
Foy. And once you get through Foy, then everything is turning, and then you find out that Patton's coming, and everything, and the Battle of the Bulge is over. At what cost? That was the other thing that we all wanted it. I knew that I wanted it. So at what cost? And then the big thing was all this information, and I didn't ask Tom. I didn't ask anybody else. I just wrote narration. I said, hell with it. I'm going to have this thing narrated by Lipton because I like the idea of the unreliable narrator to a degree, which is he is narrating the story, but he's leaving out the most important thing, which is it's his story and he held the company together because he's never going to talk about that. So I had him narrate it. And, Tom's initial reaction was, "This is fantastic. And this is so good. We want you to write another episode. We want you to work on four." Okay. And he said, "A little too much narration." I said, "Tom, I think there was one point when I was writing narration and I'd started to think about more narration that would go inside the narration. So I was going to have like, narration upon narration." He laughed, and I said, "I understand." And we pared it back. Another thing about the narration was, Donnie just did it, in a just a temp version. Just read it straight in a studio, just so we could have it to cut with, that Frankel could have it to cut with. And I don't think he got Donnie back. He said he did it so perfectly because he wasn't trying to perform it at all. He was just reading the words. And it was very Lipton. So the narration was huge. Battlefield promotion was huge. And then, I joked with Mikhail Solomon because he directed Carrington, and he said, "Your episode is really depressing." And I said, "Well, I'm sorry, Mikhail, but it's a war story. It's, because I did the thing where they're sitting, listening to these young women singing, and I thought, let's see who's lost. Let's have people disappear on screen. Let's see these people and then have them vanish, and to remind the audience of what the cost has been of the Bulge in particular, but also just the whole thing. And it's not all dead. I mean, it's Garnier and Toy are just off the
Off
and
the company,
Compton's off
exactly.
the, yeah, they're just out of the picture. But that still gets me.
Yeah, I love that scene.
There's a
I,
couple.
I'm, I, I'm
There's a and it, well, and it's just this beautiful music, and it's peace, but there's, it's war and it's horrifying.
It's longing for the guys that you started out with.
Yeah. So that's the basic writing. And then I don't know if anyone warned you, but you just pull, there's an old doll back in the 60s called Chatty Cathy, and you just pull the string and it goes. You pulled my string. You jump in
No,
anytime, but
I'm loving this. This is great.
okay. So I mean, I can tell. So the next big thing was, David Frankel wanted me out for the week before production began, because he wanted more work done. So I got to go to England and stay at the Dorchester, which, by the way, had its own bomb shelter during World War II. And all the fancy people who stayed there would run down there. And there's all sorts of wild bed hopping stories about the Dorchester back then. But anyway, I got to stay there and go out to the set. And one of the things was, I'm in production offices and all these young actors are running around, and they've all got English accents. And I'm thinking, could a bunch of Americans come over here? And now they're all talking with their English accents. And then I realized, oh no, they're actually English actors, and the American accents are just perfect. So I went around and I met all the actors, and Frankel want two things. He said, "Listen, I know we're not supposed to, but we're going to take their helmets off as much as possible so we can see their faces. We just have to do it in a position where it feels like it's reasonably safe." And he said, "I want more stories. I want more of particularly Muck and Pinkala, but also Garnier, because Babe Heffron has now become a big. I want that relationship because we're going to lose Garnier. We're going to lose Toy. We're going to lose Buck. We're going to lose." So I did worked on stuff with talk to Neil, because all these guys, all the actors, if the person they were portraying was still alive, like we didn't have that with Nixon, but we had it with Winters. Damien talked to Winters a lot, and Donnie talked to Carwood a lot. And so and I'm blanking on his name, who played Skip Muck, and I've Spate, Richard Spate, who I've gotten to know over the years. He put him in put them in Justified. You know, I mean, I like using these. I like working with these because I know they're good and they can do anything. I just finished Shane Taylor, who played Eugene Rowe, one of the most heartfelt, beautiful, soulful performances I've ever seen. Just played a total asshole in Silo for at the end of season three and through much of season four, and was fantastic. You know, it's just like they're really good at their jobs, and they're good people. So at any rate, Frankel just said we need to care more about Makkapokala. We need to care more. We need to be reminded about Garnier and Heffron, and we need, you know, what do these guys talk about in the foxhole? So I just went
They
to them
talk about
and.
going over, crossing Niagara Falls, the Niagara River,
The Niagara River, swimming across the Niagara, because Spade had reached out to the family, and they had responded, and they had exchanged, and they were just absolutely stoked that Grandpa, who none of them had met because he died in the freaking war, was going to be part of this story. And so they wrote letters, and so he had this Richard had this information, and so I turned that into a scene. And then there was stuff with Garnier and Heffron that, you know, Frank had been Frank knew Garnier pretty damn well. And Robin Granger played, who was, by the way, total, just absolute thick as Scottish accent you'll ever hear in your life, played Heffron, and knew the Heffron family, and these people are still part of those families. I mean, they
That's really good.
still are in touch with them. They'll go see them. I mean, it changed the actors' lives. It changed the families' lives. So then they had these stories to tell. And so I go back to the hotel room with my laptop that was, you couldn't just plug it. I had to have a converter that would sort of
Of
overheat.
course,
Remember
of course, of
those? I
course.
mean, it was like plug a computer into that, and that was going into the wall, and it was humming and hissing, and sparks were flying. No,
No, but whenever you
there were no
plug that in
sparks.
and it
But
starts getting hot, you keep wondering, okay, when is this going to die on me?
exactly. So I rewrote those. I added those scenes, which became critically important to the success of the episode.
Now, do you
And then,
remember? And I don't know. There is the scene where Buck is basically showing the picture of himself with his girlfriend, and you get the impression that from that scene, that was a, that he had gotten a Dear John letter, but it's
I
never
honestly.
explained. It's just shown. Okay.
I can't remember. That's lost to history. I know that I got to know Neil, and I know that when we were casting
I
Boomtown,
know.
originally that part was supposed to be
Oh,
Hispanic,
really?
and I said, "Oh yeah," and I said, "F it, let's make it Irish, and let's get Neil McDonough." And this is okay. So
I love him in
we
that
don't
role
have the.
in Boomtown.
So we did. Oh, so we didn't have the final go to make the pilot. We were still casting. Had to cast Andrea, and we got Nina Garbieris, and we had, you know, various parts, and we got Gedrick, for Christ's sakes, and it was fantastic. And but we were still looking for who was going to play David McNorris, and we wanted it to be Neil. And so we had to do one of these things where he auditioned for all the heads of casting at NBC and Jeff Zucker, the head of
Oh, wow.
NBC. And what Neil did is he did the big monologue he has in the first episode, where he says, "I can't remember that person's name, but I remember blah blah blah," and he does this whole thing, and it's this real show moment in the episode. He came in and he didn't say hi or anything. He just came into Zucker's office and he said, "I don't remember everyone's name, but I do remember their faces because blah blah." And he did the whole speech and then turned and left. And that was it. There was no small talk. There was no chit chat. He just did it, left, and Zucker said, "Go make your pilot." And that was a big change of life for me. And I got to work with Neil on that, on Justified, and I'll work with him whenever I can. So that was the writing of it, and then into production, and I was there just, you know, mostly just to do the rewrites to just bolster these stories, and then everything up was up to Frankel and the team, and you know, and off they went, and I didn't hear anything until I got a VHS tape from Frankel, you know, of several months later, and I put that on, and it was like, okay, this is now the best thing I've ever done. And I was so proud, and just happy to have my name on it. And the only other thing would be episode four, so The Replacements. And we'll see how much time we have. I don't have to dwell on this a lot, but they gave me carte blanche. They didn't want to spend a lot of money. I said, I came up with a whole different story for that episode. I had it. We about characters we've never met before who are Graves registrations guys. That's their job. I said, what if we did something about the guys who had to clean up after D-Day? And I spoke to vets and they talked about what that was like to be on a train. They didn't know where they were going and the train stops and then the guy gets on and says, you're going to Graves registration. That's going to be your job. And they're like, oh, fuck,
Exactly.
no. But they did it. And they were proud of the work they did, and they could never really talk about it because it was just so horrifying. But one of the guys said, if we hadn't done our job after the first wave landed at Normandy, the second wave would not have
Right.
landed. You
That's
know,
right.
and that's, you know, so I did that, and they said, thanks, but no thanks. We're just going to do Eindhoven. Oh, and this was the other thing. And Tom said, look, we're way over budget. We got to save money on this episode. So this is going to be no daytime drop into Eindhoven. We're just going to get into Ninen. This is going to be bull in a barn, bull
That's
in a
right.
barn. And I was now working on Boomtown. And so McKenna was brought in to really take up much of the rewriting, and we share credit on it, but it's more his episode than mine. The big thing that I wrote was that's in it is the Battle of Neunen. And if you even pronounce it that, but that's where, because I made the whole story about that there were two people with the same last name who died in that battle, and one was a replacement, and it was like whose body is this? I made that the mystery of the show, and that ended up being I think it's James McAvoy
Right,
is the character who died.
Miller. Miller was the name. James Miller.
Yeah, and which
Which
is, you know,
again, the
also the
same
name
thing.
of, yeah, Private Ryan. But so I made it about that. But that battle was important to me because I would talk to Bull. By the way, no one had talked to Bull. Like Bull was very hard to reach. And then I talked to him and he's like, I just had the wrong number, you know, and then everyone was talking to Bull. I remember something about that. I don't know if that's accurate, but it what I got was that if you talk to this person, if you talk to like you know, Shifty Powers, or you talk to, you know, I talked to Lipton again, or I talk, you know, every person's account of that battle was very different, but you could see that, oh, I heard that going on. And then you talk to this guy and he's over there where that
And he
was
said, I
going
heard.
on, and he was unaware of what else, and that was Boomtown, which was everyone knows that I said in battle, everyone knows only the 12 feet around them. That's it. That's all they've got. Unless you're, you know, dumb like Carwood in the second episode and climb a tree, you don't know what's going on. You can some stuff if you've got a radio man, you can find out something, but basically that's it. And so that stuck with me was which is the battle gets pieced together by piecing these stories together. At any rate, Bull in a Barn. It was going to be about that. It was just him and that night hiding out in the barn, and that's the whole episode. Well, then David Nutter comes on as a director, and this is my classic whine about Hollywood, is the writer, we like to say things like dusk and sunset, and we're told it's either day or night, and then the director comes in and says it's going to be dusk, and it's like, oh, for God's sake. So I cut out the daylight drop in Eindhoven because it was just too expensive. And Nutter came in and said, hey, could we do a daylight drop? And all the crew people, you know, the parachute people are like, absolutely, we can do it. And so it gets done. And it's a great episode. And I got to, you know, work with McKenna, and he and I worked together not only on Pacific, but on other things as well. So it established that relationship. So I got to do, you know, I say 1.5 episodes. I really consider Breaking Point to be, if people ask me, you know, what are you proudest of? I would say, you know, it's not Speed. I love Speed. Speed changed my life, but I'm proud of because and Joss Whedon rewrote all the dialogue in the script, so my ownership of it is just the structure of
The
it.
idea of
I
having a
feel
bus that
that.
will explode if it goes under 55 miles. That's it. Where did
Yeah,
do you remember where
that's
you came up with
me.
that idea from?
Okay, so what I say now is, do you know what it's like when a magic trick gets
Yes,
explained to
it's
you and
no
you
longer.
go,
Okay.
that's all it is?
All right. That's a
Okay,
good answer.
so do you want to know it?
I don't mind.
Okay, so I'll tell you, which is my dad had a show on Canada television about movies for 25 years. My dad loved movies. And he came to me one day, knew I wanted to be a writer. I was getting started writing some script. He said, I heard about a Kurosawa script about a train that can't slow down or it'll blow up. And then a couple of years later, out comes Runaway Train, written by Akira Kurosawa, directed by Andrei Konchalovsky and stuff.
Right.
There's no bomb. It's just they can't get to the brakes. They're going through Alaska and it's all frozen. And I came out of that theater and I said, that wasn't bad. That was fun. Because a friend of mine said, Runaway Train, what's that
Now,
about? And that kind
I
of
have a
summed it
question for
up.
you.
You know, it's like, yes.
I'm not sure if you're, I'm assuming you're familiar with the sitcom Mad About You, okay, with Paul Reiser. Right. That's right. He pulls it. I love that. I love that. I love that. It's just like in the cold opening. He just like is going through his wallet and he goes, bomb on a bus. Blows up if he's going under 55 miles. Damn, I wish I would have thought
Oh,
of that
yeah.
first.
Oh, like he pulls the thing out of the thing. Oh, bus, yeah. No, I love the fact that it's part of the culture. It's, 30 plus years on now and all of that. And I'm proud of that. But at any rate, so I came out of seeing Runaway Train and I said, it'd be better if it was a bus because trains are so linear. I was already solving the problem. If there was a bomb, what would you do? You would get helicopters in and you would get people off. You would just track the train, you would land, get people off, and away you go. Shunt it around. Bus is more Connecticut. You can stop and well, I got to go this way,
Okay.
and then I say it'd be way better if it's a bomb. And I just noodle on it, and I was moving from TV writing into for kids a kids network, and in trying to get a job with a big network, and I had some time off, and I wrote it then in 1991, and it sold that summer, and that changed my life as well. But
And Keanu's.
and candles and. And everyone knew that Sandra Bullock was going to be a star. It was so funny in the casting of that. It was a long time to figure out who was going to play Jack, but the casting people were like, no, Sandra Bullock. And it's like, oh yeah. She was ready to just burst. We knew. She was just, it was everything. But Band of Brothers, Boomtown Pilot, Justified Pilot, another episode of Boomtown, the episode called Fearless toward the end of the first season. Those are the things that I'm most proud of. There's some stuff in Silo that I'm incredibly proud of that offer just other people's episodes more than my own. But in terms of stuff I've written, I would say that part seven of Band of Brothers is I'm lucky that I got to do that, and I'm lucky. The thing I wrote for Earth to the Moon, Apollo 1. I'm proud of that too, and that had one of those things of like, oh, now I know what this episode is, and I realize it's going to be a detective story, and the detective is going to be Frank Borman, who's an astronaut. He's trying to figure out what killed his friends. That's the story. And then I realized, oh, structurally, I'm going to steal from Peter Weir and his brilliant movie Fearless. We're going to see a little bit of the accident at the beginning, right off the top, and then we'll see the whole thing when it's testimony later, and we get them second by second what happened to those poor guys. So things like that, when you get the answer, you go, okay, now I know how to tell this story. And then, the thing that they've Scott said about me that I got the culture right. We had a lot of we got a lot of feedback on Band that we got the culture right, and a lot of that came from Ambrose. A lot of that came to talking to the men, which is, no one's an idiot. They're doing the best they can. They can have different dialects. They can shifty powers can talk kind of slow, but they're pretty smart people in their own way. And so give them that respect. And I think the respect given to Sobel, was also critically important because even though he was an asshole, They all said they wouldn't have been who they were
That's
and
right.
what they became if it hadn't been for him, you know? So it all of that stuff was critically important. So and then I saw the episode, and then we get to go to Paris and France for a week for the premiere, and it was like, holy shit, that was just jaw-dropping. They rented a train to take us out to Normandy to, and they built tents, one tent to show the episode part two, and one tent to feed us and have a dance band. We got our own damn train. We get off the train, and there's all these little French school children waving little paper American flags that they've made. Course, my thought was, I know what it's like to have little children, and I can imagine they're in school, and the teacher is going, "More! You need to produce four flags an hour. Come on!" But yeah, it was one of the greatest experiences of my life. And then, getting to be involved with Pacific was a whole different thing. Band of Brothers, ultimately, I would say, is a love story. It's a war story, but it's a love story. It's about these men and how much they love each other. I'm not going to be, beat around the bush or they admire each other, care. No, it was love. They to see them the years on. I mean, these guys were in their early 80s when we got to really hang with them, and man, they just gave each other shit all the time, and they just adored each other, and they would say stuff about each other and blah blah blah. But they just, oh God, they were that band of brothers. And then to work on Pacific, which was all these disparate stories, and there wasn't that one unique group, but there was a sense of this vast canvas, and Pacific really was, as McKenna said, that's an anti-war movie. Because it shows what it's
It's
really like. It shows
much more
how
brutal.
bad. Oh, Iwo Jima and Okinawa were just, and Peleliu. And to me, it was summed up by the pebble in the skull, in that scene when Snafu does that, and when he stops Sledge from doing it. That to me was the whole show. But yeah. So got to do those Masters. Different thing. I was on that for a year and a half working with Orloff, and we had some tussling. We worked it out, and then I found out that the director they brought on was going to rewrite me, and I said, I got other stuff I got to do. So I left it before it went into production. So that's the closest I've come to serving. Just writing about these guys. Oh, my wife and I went to a wedding weekend before in San Francisco, in the Presidio. A lot of Marines, because the groom is still a Marine. Still a Marine? He might be out, but at any rate, no, I think he's still a Marine because they're figuring out where he's going to be posted next. A pilot, Marine pilot, and so a lot of Marines. And I joked to Connie, I said, just wait to see how long it takes for me to mention Band of Brothers in the Pacific. And we sat down in the pews, in the seats, and there was a pilot guy, and he said, "What are you doing? I'm a Marine. I'm out of the Marines. I'm flying for America." And his wife is still in the Marines. She's in Okinawa in intelligence. And I said, "Yeah, I worked on Band of Brothers in the Pacific." And Connie looked at me and she said, "I thought it was going to take you longer than that." So I wear that proudly.
Yeah, I
It's
mean, one of the things that always
one of the high
amazes me,
points.
when I've talked to all of you guys that have been connected to the production, how, it's pretty much unheard of in the television or even movie world, that 25 years later people are still, in contact, getting together, having reunions. I mean, based on what you just said, also,
When
when you're trying to cast another show or movie that you're doing, you're going to use the same guys that you did before, not just because you think they're great actors, but also because you have a connection to them and you can trust them. I mean,
You get to
it's
spend,
twofold. It's
and you
twofold.
can trust them, and you get to spend time with them. It's a great excuse. I mean, I'd never spent much time with Shane Taylor or Robin Granger, but when they were in Silo, we got to hang out a fair amount. And Ross McCall, met him at a thing that was in Cleveland, a Band of Brothers thing, and had never really hung out with him, but Gomez was hanging out with him. I got to know him, and he was just a hoot. And so I like to, work with Ross as much as possible. And yeah, that bond is deep. Yeah, it's just, yeah. I said, when I was working on Earth to the Moon, I had this little photograph of Ed White on a in a spacewalk
Okay.
outside the capsule, in floating in space, and he died in Apollo 1. And it's like, I'm doing this for Ed. And that was a responsibility. And then along comes Band of Brothers, and it's like, holy shit, these guys saved the world. They saved the
That's right.
world. They were part of that. The greatest fight ever. And that's a responsibility. So do not fuck
100%.
it up. You know.
Okay, you mentioned Ed White. You mentioned Ed White.
That
Yeah.
said, that I
No, go ahead. No, you mentioned
no,
Ed White. So it just
go.
reminded me of one of my favorite lines from that episode. Where they ask Borman, what does he know about the three guys? And he tells the janitor story about Roger Chaffee. And I'm like, wow. Again, I don't know if that is from your mind or if it was something that really happened. I mean, but
It's
it's
true.
just an amazing, it's an amazing
He would
story.
talk. He talked to the guys who made the tools that made the tools, and it was just because he understood. They all understood that their lives depended on these people, but they just really admired them and their work. And then I got to do the episode. I got to direct the episode about the building of the lander, and Tom Kelly was just such a genius, but also just in the thing it, just the doing of it. My son ended up becoming an engineer, and so I appreciate the hell out of them. But yeah, it's it's I love paying tribute to people who do stuff that I just could not do, and never got called upon. And there was this great moment at the LA premiere of a band, which was at the Hollywood Bowl with an orchestra. I mean, it was just nuts. And Stephen Ambrose got up, and it was September 9th, 2001. And he gets up. It wasn't actually, no, it was the week before that, because the band premiered September 9th, Sunday, September 9th, 2 days before the world changed. But this was the weekend before. At any rate, Ambrose got up and he said, people call them the greatest generation. I think that any generation who gets called to serve will do just as well. And he understood that too, because he knew, because that's what the men thought. They didn't think they were special. They didn't think they were the greatest generation. They
That's right.
just, that's what came along. America was attacked. Fascism was on a rampage. We have to do something, and we may have to die, but it has to be done. And so, yeah, I never got called to do that. Hanks has said, thank God that he grew up in a time where he was too young for Vietnam and too old for anything that came after, and I
Understood.
feel exactly the same way.
And
Your country is
I have
different.
served, and
You've got to
I'm
serve,
very familiar with it.
because
So
yeah, my friend who was in the IDF, that was just
but
part of it.
it
That was
goes with the
just,
same thing. It's a love for country
So
and a love
anyway.
to for freedom. That's what it comes down.
For freedom, and yeah, Israel is a small dot of blue in a giant part of the world that
That's right.
elections
Here
don't
they
matter.
do.
So, when any,
Here they do.
and what? They do. They do matter.
It
That doesn't mean
never
everything
is.
is squeaky clean and like it is in
Yeah, of
America or
course.
anything. There's fucked up shit. Never the great Ben Franklin line, democracy is the worst form of government except for all the other ones. And right. And but anyway, it's great talking to you, and I'm sorry I had to just spew.
No,
The coffee is
Graham,
good.
this was amazing. Thank you very much. You've given me so much to it's so much more to mull over, but thank you very much. I do appreciate it.
Well, I have no idea what's going on with any of this. I'm just always happy to talk about band. We had a thing down in New Orleans a few years ago, and you get called, you show up, you get to hang with these guys and shoot
Exactly.
the shit, give each other shit, and talk about something that changed your life. And that was just, it's still, When people say, "Oh, you're a writer, what have you written?" I'll mention The Bus Movie and I'll mention Band of Brothers.
Which
And
one
when you're
you mention first?
usually I'll start with Speed, and because it's a movie and because it did enter the culture in a way. But so did Band. But Speed is, oh, I love that. Band, you know what Band gets? Band gets my family and I watch that every year.
Yeah, okay, that's right. Makes sense. All
Okay.
right.
See you,
Thank you
man.
very much, Graham. I
You got it.
appreciate
Thank
it.
you. You
All
got it.
right.
Take care.